morning, good afternoon, good evening, everybody. This is Tony, and you're listening to a brand new episode of Tales from the Couch Zone. And as always, I'm joined by my co-host, Dazza. Dazza, how are you doing today?
Doing very well, thank you. How are you?
I'm doing just fine. Thanks for asking, Dazza. All right. We talked about it off air. And going forward, Dazza, we don't really have anything lined up for today. So the plan for today's show is we are going to do two years, the TKO 170 as far as our top 10 for Rate and Slate for the year 2000 and 2001 this week. Am I right, Dazza?
That is correct. There's no real sort of big news thing that I feel really passionate about talking about. So rather than just sort of like, you know, bimbo through something and try to pretend that we care about the UFC event that's coming up this week for the pretend belt, rather than do something like that, I thought we'd just be, you know, do what we actually do and enjoy, and that is going through the top 10 for the previous years.
Yes. All right. Rate and Slate for the year 2000.
Shall we just explain what we're going to be doing the next couple of weeks?
Ooh, that too. All right,
let's
forego that just for a second, and let's explain to folks what we're going to be doing from the future here on in. Let's explain to the folks.
Okay, yeah. Well, basically, as the little bit of Christmas music sort of attested, we're in December now, so it's all festive and everything, and we're coming to the end of the year. So basically, as next show, which we'll be recording next week, will basically be our another of our top 10 series. We're going to go through our top 10. Either Christmas movies or Christmas episodes of a television. So it's going to be a mixture of both. So basically anything of sort of any film or TV that has some sort of Christmas connotation somewhere in there is eligible for our choices. And we're basically going to go through our top tens for those.
Top 10 Christmas specials. I love it.
Yeah. And then after that, it will be getting close to the New Year. So basically there's going to be two possibly episodes. So I've not worked everything out yet, but one is going to be sort of like a top 10, both our top 10 choices of the best moments film and TV of 2016. So basically a mixture of sort of either TV series, a particular TV episode, or a particular film. But basically were the ones that we basically sort of really loved in 2016. So we're going to go through that. And then right at the end of the year, we're going to look ahead to 2017. So we're going to look at what the films are for 2017, and we're basically both going to come up with our top 10 of the films that we are most looking forward to in 2017.
There you go. I certainly love, and I think people have gotten used to the specialty show that we do now. So it's becoming a regular thing here. So I'm looking forward to just doing the show. I can't imagine what people are as far as listening to the show. So Very exciting. All right. I have my TKO170.com pulled up. Let's look up the top 10 films of the year 2000. Starting at number 10, Dazza. Scary Movie. Number 9, X-Men. Number 8, The Perfect Storm. Number 7, Meet the Parents. Number 6, How the Grinch Stole Christmas. Number 5, Dinosaur. Number 4, What Women Want. Number 3, Castaway. Number 3, or number 2, I should say. Sorry, I'm losing track of my numbers here. Number 2, Gladiator. And at number 1, according to TKO170.com's box office receipts, Mission Impossible 2. Dazza, it's a pretty good year, all things considered, considering what we've had for the last couple of years in the 90s, sort of really strong in the 90s and then sort of just tampered off. I'm looking at the list, not just in the top 10, but also in the top 50. And it seems like cinema has recovered to a degree.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at this list, there's one sequel in there, but whereas we're starting to be getting a bit dominated by sequels and sort of gimmicky comedies, this one's got quite a bit of a variety to it. You know, there's a few kids' films in there. You know, you got the X-Men, which obviously started off a new franchise and was one of the ones that basically kicked off Marvel's, the interest in Marvel movies as a viable property. But yeah, there's a good mix here. It's not exactly probably the most spectacular looking back of sort of classic movies, but that is a pretty solid list.
Yes. Before we look at the remaining 50 films or the remaining 40, let's look at the top 10 and let's go with our Rate and Slate. Dazza, for the year 2000, what is going to be your rate?
My rate is going to be a film which is sort of is one that, on the face of it, was probably not going to be sort of a spectacular film, but I really, really enjoyed. I found really surprising, and that's Castaway.
Oh, okay, interesting choice.
Yeah, I mean, basically, it's just it's one of those films where you just see how good someone like Tom Hanks is. Mm-hmm. Because he basically, you know, for most of his film, he is basically in solitude. You know, he's basically, you know, to actually sort of carry the whole sort of Robinson Crusoe type, you know, vibe about him, but basically sort of, you know, totally alone on this island. And also obviously the companion that he has in Wilson, the basketball who he sort of makes as his friend and everything. And he just gets so into that character, and you sort of go along with him when you get the impression at times that he's starting to basically go insane. You know, when he starts to actually have arguments with Wilson and everything. And there's also that moment when he sort of escapes from the island, and it's that heartbreaking moment when he actually loses, you know, Wilson. And, you know, it's weird because you basically do really feel for him. You know, you've sort of, and I mean, when I was watching it, that sort of bit affected me, and it sort of realized that I'd sort of started to see Wilson as an actual person, you know, as an actual sort of character. You know, but like I said, the whole thing, you know, any other actor, I doubt very much could have carried this off. But there's something about Tom Hanks that he's got this thing about it that he's just sort of, I don't know if it's like his real life persona carries over, but you've just got like real sympathy for him.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? You're just sort of, I think another actor who's pretty much the same is Will Smith. Mm-hmm. You know, when he's doing sort of like, you know, the serious roles. There's a film that film Pursuit of Happiness. My mum basically refuses to watch that film because she says she can't, you know, because she likes Will Smith, and she says, and she just can't bear the thought of Will Smith basically being down and out and homeless and everything. You know, she just sort of can't bear that, you know. And I think Tom Hanks is that same sort of, you know, same sort of actor. And I just think it's an amazing film, very heartbreaking in many ways and everything, but sort of like, you know, To me, it was like a real triumph and a bittersweet, you know, feel-good movie.
Okay. I certainly can't argue with that film, Dazza. Fine choice, if I do say so myself. As far as what I'm going to pick for my rate, now there's a couple of honorable mentions on this list. Obviously, the comedy classic Meet the Parents, I'm a big fan of. I'm curious to see if it winds up on your slate, Dazza. Also, Perfect Storm, like pretty good film as well. X-Men, some would think that that's the film that I'd go with maybe for my rate this year, but for those of you who think that way, you'd be incorrect. For my rate for the year 2000, I'm probably gonna go with Mission Impossible 2. Of all things, I don't know, of all these top 10 films, that's the film I remember having the most fond memories watching that film. It wouldn't be till later iterations that I'd finally stop caring about the movie, but I think 2 was probably the peak of when I still cared about the Mission Impossible franchise. And looking at this top 10, at least as far as my opinion is concerned, I'm probably gonna go with that. I really like it, so it was a fun action movie of its time. To a degree, I guess you could say it was maybe Tom Cruise's swan song as far as him being a relevant actor in my eyes, and just like I said, the franchise to a degree, and I just remember having fond memories of that film. It was a great action film. I remember when I started collecting VHS films back in the day. I think this was one of the first films I started collecting, and I don't really have a whole lot more to say about it other than I really like it. It's a great action film. Obviously, to a degree, it's of its time. There's some things that probably haven't aged particularly well. For those of you who are big on metal, it's weird how the band Metallica, they produced a single for this song with the idea eventually they were going to make an album, but I guess that fell through. So all we had to go for from as far as being a Metallica fan was just this one song that they made for Mission Impossible 2, which was odd, but I like the song. It's a good song. I wouldn't say it's one of their best, but certainly a fun song for them. So as far as the TKO170.com top 10 list for box office receipts for the year 2000, I'm going to go with Mission Impossible 2. I'm curious to see if it winds up on Dazza's slate. Dazza, what do you have for your slate for the year 2000?
Yeah, I mean, Mission Impossible 2 isn't going to go on my slate. Basically, I could never put a John Woo movie on a slate. You know, it's just, you know, the guy's incredible, can do sort of like, you know, really great action movies and everything like that.
Usually I know you pretty well. I can kind of sometimes see where you're coming from. I can kind of maybe predict the way you think. But when I'm looking at the top 10 list, there's so many ways you can go. So I can't say one way or another which way you're going to wind up going.
Yeah. I think the one on this that is sort of really going to that I'll pick for my slate, and it's kind of a personal thing because it was more a sort of a disappointment than anything, is how the Grinch Stole Christmas, which is quite apt. And I think one of the things is that as a kid, I used to love the Dr. Seuss books. They had them all the Dr. Seuss books in the library at school when I was like 5 or 6 and learning to read. And it was just something about them that just sort of, they weren't like any other kids' book. We just had this really different feel. It's almost like, even though I wouldn't know it at the time, almost like a punk rock type anarchism to them.
I don't think I've ever heard that described of Dr. Seuss.
That's how I saw them at the time, but because they were so different, you know, but they weren't, so, you know, the characters and everything, they weren't, maybe it's different in America, but in the UK it was also to like all the kids, like picture books and everything for that age were really, really safe and sort of like nice and, you know, sort of, and also to had a bit of a moral to them. Whereas Dr. Seuss, they just felt a bit different. They just felt a bit sort of like, you know, sort of out of the ordinary, you know, just sort of, you know, a bit weird. And so I actually was looking forward to this, and the whole film just doesn't meet the tone of what I expected. And it's also, I found all the characters, even apart from the Grinch, just something like really unsettling to watch.
Yeah.
I just didn't like the design of the characters. They just, it was just a sort of like, just a very weird viewing experience. And I just thought as a whole, the whole thing, I mean, you know, Jim Carrey just, You would have thought he was perfect in the role, and he just came across as more annoying than anything. And I just really, really couldn't get into the film at all. It just didn't, you know, and this should have been to me like a different kind of Christmas movie. And it just wasn't. And to be honest, it's the same with the Cat in the Hat movie.
Oh, yes. To a far greater degree.
Yeah, I felt exactly the same thing about it. It just didn't, you know, it just didn't translate properly. I think it's one of these things that probably it doesn't translate to a live action movie. I think an animated version, which I think they have actually, I do remember there being an animated movie as a kid, which was based purely on the illustrations and everything. But to me, this one was just something that just didn't work.
I don't think it's a live action thing. I think as far as my slate, I'm going to agree with you as well. Although there's certainly a far number of honorable mentions, not excluding obviously Dinosaur, which I don't know why back in the day I was very, very much looking forward to that film when I saw the trailer for it. You know, it was a CGI movie in 2000, and I was excited for it, and I saw it. It was kind of boring. And the other honorable mention that I have right here is obviously Scary Movie. I thought you would have gone in that direction, maybe, if I had to pick one way or another. It seemed like such low-hanging fruit, but I'm going to have to agree with you there, Dazza. How the Grinch Stole Christmas was my original idea for a slate, so I'm glad you agree with me here. Yeah, it's one of those things where it's a huge disappointment. Obviously, it's one of these things on paper. You're looking at it. It's like, you're going to do How the Grinch Stole Christmas, and you're going to have Jim Carrey in the role. I'm like, little skeptical, but it sounds like it's a pretty good film. Obviously, it's the Grinch, so I can't imagine how you could screw that up. Although they found a way to do it, I don't think so much. It's a thing where it doesn't translate to a live thing. I think it's the fact that they took so many liberties with the original story, because there is in fact that animated feature based off the book, and The problem with that, it's a really short, simple story. And the idea that you're going to go out there and tell a 90-minute to 2-hour story based off that, it's like, okay, you can't really do that without adding to it. And what they added to the original story wasn't very interesting. And like I said, they felt the need to be quote unquote creative, and the stuff they did, I just didn't much care for. Just the idea that he was just this child who I guess liked Christmas growing up, and then he had this traumatic event. It's like, okay, I'm not buying it. I don't really care. And the fact that they gave him a love interest, I thought even was even worse. To me, it's one of these things where it shouldn't have been made just because it wasn't really. It shouldn't have been a 90-minute film, and the idea that they thought they could pull a fast one on or take liberties with the original story, it's like, okay, you guys tried and you fell flat in your face, so maybe you shouldn't have tried something like this from the get-go. And even honestly, the Jim Carrey performance in this film, I don't know. I think it was one of these things to where people kind of thought Jim Carrey was a certain thing, even in the year 2000. Obviously, you've seen performances of his, like in The Mask, and then to a degree, I guess you would say, in like Batman and Robin. So you sort of thought he was this sort of, I guess, to a degree, this Robin Williams light. And this film, more than anything, really showed that he really was his own thing. And the idea that you're going to go out there and give him and have him do like Robin Williams-esque type performance. And it's like, okay, this really isn't fitting for the guy. It really comes off forced and it's not particularly funny. In fact, that probably would have been a better way to go now that I think about it. Maybe doing a Robin Williams in this role. But, obviously when people think of this film, they think of the facials that Jim Carrey has, and those sort of translated, but you can't really make a film around that. So I'm going to have to agree with you as far as my slate for the year 2000. I'm going to have to go with How the Grinch Stole Christmas.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting, you know, the other choices that was on offer, because you mentioned Scary Movie. Mm-hmm. And I've not actually thought of that for my slate, because that was the film that I thought, you know, was okay, you know, I sort of like the Kaiser Soze, the thing. But the weird thing about that movie, and this is because by this time the whole sort of spoof movie thing, you know, the things like from the airplane police squad type movies, is this one was based. This was a spoof of a film that was already a spoof. You know what I mean? It was because Scream was basically almost a satire on horror movies, because it played with all the, you know, with all the cliches. It was done straight. You know, it was done in a straight manner. But whereas this was obviously slapstick. But you started to get this as well later on. You would get movies that were basically, there were spoofs on comedies. Which, you know, to me, a comedy, it can, you know, stuff like, for example, there was one film that basically made jokes about Hancock. And it's like, well, to me, these films only really work if you're basically doing a spoof of something which is straight edge serious. Mm-hmm. You know, when Hancock, for example, was like a bit of a comedy about superheroes. But if you're doing a spoof on a film which is already making fun of a genre, then what's the point of that? And this became sort of like a theme of these films, that they just got very, very lazy in the fact that they were basically just sort of, you know, just sort of like, you know, pretty much doing recreations and gags on, you know, on Duray, so just whatever happened to be the blockbusters at the time.
Yeah, and it's like, okay, originally, I agree with you there. It's sort of, let's do parodies of whatever horror movie they felt like making fun of. But I think this series wound up eventually evolving into, oh, what's ever popular in pop culture, and that'll be the basis of our film. It's like, okay, you guys are clearly, I've gone off the beaten trail, and you guys have run out of material as far as what to make fun of. And yeah. This is sort of the beginning of the Wayne's Empire of these awful movies.
One of the later ones I thought was I quite like. It was one with they sort of made a bit of fun of Signs, and it had Charlie Sheen in it, who was sort of like made the film sort of, you know, quite watchable. But we had a scene in that which basically means I'm pretty sure it will never get shown on television again, where basically he gets into a fight with Michael Jackson, who's tried to sneak in the house to molest the kids. You know, so that film ain't ever getting shown on TV again, I would have thought.
Not anytime soon, no. Can't imagine. All right, that's going to do it for our rate and slate for the year of 2000. This is something we've been doing as of late that I felt like adding into the show. I'm looking at the remaining 40 films on this list and just doing honorable mentions. Let's see what we have. Gone in 60 Seconds, I'm a big fan of.
I love that film for two reasons. First off, Angelina Jolie is absolutely hot as hell in that movie. I mean, she was, and there's a scene where she's basically there with what she does to her handbrake is kind of like, you know, unbearable to watch at times. But I also love that film because, and I don't know if he's actually that well known in America, but there's a ex-footballer called Vinnie Jones. Mm-hmm. Who was basically, it was in a film called Lock, Stock and Two Smoking Barrels, and this film basically made perfect use of him because he's got that sort of, he's got almost like a star presence about him, but he's not a very good actor. So they did the best thing to do. They had him in the film as a deaf and dumb mute. That's absolute genius because you got the best of both worlds then. You got this basically like this like really sort of charismatic looking hard guy, but you kept him from talking. So he didn't
Yeah, that's certainly very interesting, that.
Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon.
Oh, God. Had that been on the top 10, obviously we reserve our rate and slate for what makes its way in the top 10. That probably would have been my rate had it gone a little bit higher. Although the fact that it was number 19, that's nothing to sneeze at. At 209 million worldwide, that's pretty good, all things considered. I'm looking at other films down on the list. Emperor's New Groove. I think that's a great Disney film that most people appreciate. Let's see what other films are on this list that I really like. I know there was something I really liked. Romeo Must Die. That's a great action film. And what's that?
There's not a lot beyond the.
I'm looking at this list. I'm like, oh, there would have been tons of material here. Had we expanded the thing to top 50? Because I'm looking at this list and there's tons of material here. There's Hollow Man. There's Big Mama's House. There's Nutty Professor 2, The Clumps. Let's see up in there on this list that I would have loved to rip on. Shaft.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, tons of stuff here, but unfortunately we reserve our rate and slate for our top 10. All right, Dazza, of all these films, what do you think won Best Picture in 2001?
I think I remember Gladiator winning.
You would be correct, Dazza.
Yes.
So.
Which is, you know.
It's deserving, yes. There's no arguing there.
But when you look at the, have you got the list of the nominations there?
No, I don't. What's on the
yeah, because I'm just curious, because if you look on that list, there's not a great deal that you think would be sort of like, you know, as they call Oscar bait. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, Gladiator, you know, it was a decent enough action film. It was sort of, you know, pretty spectacular. But so again, it's one of those things where I think if you watch it again now, it's kind of probably a bit cheesy, particularly, you know, the big speeches and everything. But sort of, I mean, even Russell Crowe, if you've ever seen a film called The Man with the Iron Fists, he actually spoofed that famous scene that he does, you know, the big scene where he does, like, your father to a murdered son and all this stuff. He actually spoofed that scene himself, like, you know, so, but yeah.
Yes. I'm looking at the nominations you were bringing up earlier, and yeah, you look at the rest of this list, and there was a couple of ways you could have gone. I could kind of see why you would have gone with Gladiator, but Chocolat, Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, Aaron Brockovich, and Traffic. So,
Aaron Brockovich got an Oscar nomination.
Yeah, I know. Let's sit down and think about that for a second. Yeah.
They must have been some guilt from previous years. They must not have sort of like done enough films based around a strong female lead or something, but they felt that they had to sort of do something there. I don't know. That seems a weird choice. But anyway.
All right. Let's move on to the final aspect of this year. Let's look at the 22nd Golden Razzie Awards. Now, Dazza, you know the gimmick as we always do. I list off the nominees and you try to figure out which of these five films is the worst of the bunch and which one did they decide to go with worst picture. All right. From Touchstone, we have Pearl Harbor.
I think you got the wrong year.
Are you sure?
I think it's the year before.
Yeah, you know what? I did the thing here where I put 2001 Razzies and it literally gave me for the year for the movies that came out. Okay. Got a little ahead of myself here. All right. Let's dial that back for just a second. Are you sure? Let's see. I'm looking at this. I have for 2000. Oh, jeez. Leave it to the internet to screw me up. All right. All right. I got it here now. It's 21st. Cause then I put in 2000 and they gave me all the films that came out in 1999. It's like, wait, we did this last week. All right. Going back. Let's start with Paramount. The next best thing. Other films from the other studios. Little Nicky. The Flintstones and Viva Rock Vegas. Book of Shadows, Blair Witch 2, and Battlefield. Dazza, which of these films won Worst Picture?
I'm guessing, because of its notoriety, it's going to be Battlefield Earth.
You would be correct, Dazza.
I'm two for two.
And that would actually carry on to our Worst Actor award. John Travolta and said Battlefield Earth. Oh, and also, actually, co-respectively, which I always like their usage of the word, Lucky Numbers. So for both those films. The trend of ripping on Madonna will continue in The Next Best Thing. She won Worst Actress in that. Let's see other notable entries. Worst Screen Couple. John Travolta and anyone share the screen with him in Battlefield Earth. That's mean.
But fair.
Yeah. Maybe they didn't win, but they were certainly a notable entry. Any two actors in Book of Shadows, Blair Witch 2 for worst on-screen couple. Let's see, other things. Worst remake or sequel, Book of Shadows, Blair Witch 2. Keeping up with the theme, if it's not Book of Shadows or Battlefield Earth, worst director, Roger Christian for Battlefield Earth. And worst screenplay, Battlefield Earth. Screenplay by Corey Mandel and J.D. Shrapto. Based off the L. Ron Hubbard book. That's weird. It's funny that I think this may have been the beginning of the internet years, because that's really all we have to go by. Usually they tend to go a little bit more elaborate. They'll make brand new categories where they rip on the soundtrack of a given movie. And then other categories as well. That's all we have for the year 2000.
Mm. So I know. I mean, Battlefield Earth is I think there was sort of a bias against it because it was basically heavily influenced by, obviously written by Ron L. Hubbard. It was influenced by Scientology and everything. But it was a really awful movie. I mean, it was sort of, it was just, I'm not against sort of, you know, I think there is such a thing as suspension of disbelief. You don't have to analyze it. But there were so many god-awful plot holes in that film. You know, like the fact that there sort of the aliens were like obsessed by gold. The fact that the rebels managed to, basically the human race had been wiped out in about 90 minutes apparently. And yet these guys who were basically found a bunch of jet fighters who actually learned to fly them with the manuals they found with them. I mean, it was just so much bad stuff in that film. It was really just a really, really bad movie.
I think you give L. Ron Hubbard too much credit for writing a poor script. I think really the people that hated this film and that ripped it in, Obviously, the people that put it on the Razzies, I think they just put it on there just because it's a bad movie. I think it wouldn't be.
Oh, yeah.
It wouldn't be until years later people found out what Scientology was about, and that would compound the problem that many people have with this film. But I think in the year 2000, people had no problems skewering this film and making fun of it and saying how terrible it is just on the basis of its own merit alone, Dazzle.
Yeah.
All right. Now, normally, that's where we start to go in the regular portion of the show, but because we forewent news this week, we are going to do our rate and slate 1 week in advance. So again, from TKO170.com, we have our top 10 films for the year of 2001, starting at number 10, Hannibal. Number 9, Planet of the Apes. Number 8, Jurassic Park 3. Number 7, The Mummy Returns. Number 6, Ocean's 11. Number 5, Pearl Harbor. Number 4, Shrek. Number 3, Monsters, Inc. Number 2, Lord of the Rings, The Fellowship of the Ring. And at number 1, Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone. Now, Dazza, it's a lot of great films in this bunch. What are you going to go with the worst of the bunch for your rate?
I mean, but basically, I've just got to set the record straight on one particular thing that's on this list. This is obviously made in America. Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone. It's actually Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone. Okay. that's what the book was. That was the film in the UK was. Basically, they changed the name of it because they thought that Americans wouldn't know what a philosopher was.
Oh, that's mean, but probably true.
No, that's it. They didn't think the Philosopher's Stone was marketable enough, so they changed it to the Sorcerer's Stone.
Wow.
Which is basically very, you know, I think actually offensive towards Americans and offensive towards the source material. It's like when the Madness of King George III, I think they actually changed it to Madness of King George because we're scared that people wouldn't go to see it because we're not seeing King George 1 and 2. Mm-hmm. So, you know, so just that little rant out of the way. The one I'm going to pick for my rate is the... and it's not, it's a strange pick because it's not actually my favorite film in the actual series, but I'm going to go with The Lord of the Ring, The Fellowship of the Ring.
Ooh.
Basically, because this was a film that, it took so long for someone to actually do a version of this movie. And it's a film that I think was a real sort of difficult task. And yet it's just, they just did such an, for me, the first two films, at least, just did an amazing job with the actual source material and just made this into what is sort of like, you know, a really difficult, elaborate novel into sort of like a really, really entertaining film. And one of the films which is, I think, scenery-wise, is absolutely beautiful. Mm-hmm. I mean, it really does sort of, you know, the actual, you know, this is sort of a way... I was sort of quite happy with watching them sort of like travel from place to place just because the scenery just looks so absolutely, you know, beautiful. But also they sort of, you know, what they did with the story and the characters, you know, they basically took the characters from the page and basically put them perfectly onto the screen. And one of the things that I really absolutely adored about this movie was the Dark Riders. Mm-hmm. You know, those characters were so absolutely terrifying. You know, there was just something about them that just sort of, that they just managed to get so right. It was just sort of, you know, it wasn't like the, you know, I think a lot of sort of filmmakers could sort of learn from watching them because nowadays the sort of, you know, the idea to make something scary is to give it loads of teeth and tentacles and make it, you know, really sort of like, you know, elaborate and disturbing. These were just sort of guys in cloaks, but just the presentation of them and the sort of, you know, there was just something like really scary about them. Mm-hmm. And I thought that the whole thing, you know, where it was meant to be funny, they didn't overdo the comedy element of it. They just sort of, you know, they kept it all sort of good. And this film was actually, if you watch it as well, for sort of like a family film, was really violent. I mean, you know, the battle towards the end, where, you know, with this sort of orcs. Again, this is a film where, you know, this is in the days before we really, really went into CGI. And I think it was better this way because, you know, the costumes of the orcs and everything looked real. And it looked scary and was all the better for it. And I thought, I think this was an absolutely, you know, just a fabulous film across the board. You know, some great casting choices. Mm-hmm. And I think this film was like, you know, a real, real triumph, personally.
Very much so. All right. As far as my rate, I certainly could piggyback off yours, but like I often do before I pick mine, there's several rates that I'd like to mention as well. Obviously, Ocean's 11, Shrek, I'd probably want to put on there as well. Monsters, Inc. I think I'm going to have to go with Lord of the Rings, The Fellowship of the Ring, though. Obviously, I'm not a gigantic fan of the Lord of the Rings series, but when I look at these top 10 films, the one that sticks out like a sore thumb as far as my taste in movies is concerned is probably going to go with Lord of the Rings, Fellowship of the Ring. Great film. It's one of these things to where no one had really seen anything like it up until this point. And it wouldn't be till years later that we'd see everybody doing at least some kind of rendition or some tribute to it in some way, shape, or form as far as what you would eventually see in bigger films where you'd see the big action scenes. I think this is the first film that featured the big CGI army. And, it's really hard to pick against this film. It's certainly a movie that has a fantastic story. Like you mentioned in casting in Harry Potter, the casting in this film is absolutely stellar and perfect when you consider most of the roles in this film. So when I look at these top 10, obviously you have some great notables. But for me, as far as what I think is the best of this bunch, I'm going to have to go with Lord of the Rings, The Fellowship of the Ring. All right. Let's get to the best part of this list because I can't wait for it. So I'm looking at this and there's so many ways I could possibly go. Dazzle, where are you going to go with your slate for 2001?
My slate is going to be, and to be honest, it feels like shooting fish in a barrel. I'm going to go with Pearl Harbor.
Oh, okay.
this film, it should have been great, mm-hmm. You know, to do a film on the big historical event that really did, in many ways, change the world. And they made it into like a really, really trite love story. You know, but basically, you know, the whole film was basically about a sort of a love triangle, and then the sort of like the and Pearl Harbor just happens to happen and ruin it all. But I think one of the things I have to say in sort of like researching this film, one of the complaints that I had about it, I have to sort of retract, but I always said, you know, I think the way it's done, I think a lot of people will fall into this, is the scene when the attack actually takes place, and Ben Affleck and I have to admit I forgot the other guy's name, but the other actress, the other actor, they managed to get into a fighter each, and they basically take the fight to the Japanese, and between them they shoot down about like, you know, 10 Japanese planes. And it's just done in this sort of almost unbelievable manner that you think, oh, it's just so sort of corny and everything. But this is actually based on the true part of the battle. There were two fighter pilots who managed to basically get into the fight. Because not, such a surprise attack, but there wasn't any much of a sort of counter-offensive by the Americans. But two pilots managed to get into the air, and they took down about like a sort of almost a dozen planes or something.
Wow.
You know, so there's like a real heroic. And this is the thing. When you think about the heroic acts that you saw on, but obviously we didn't see. I'm talking crap.
That's speaking from personal experience, there, Dazza.
Yeah, I in a previous life, I was I was at Pearl Harbor. I was, unfortunately, I was on the Japanese side, so you know. But we win. But yeah, the amount of heroism that would have been shown on, you know, from the, you know, the civilians and the sort of like, you know, the hospital workers and the pilots and on all the sort of, you know, the crews and everything. You know, there's such a great story in there, and that they could have just done basically 100% based on the attack. Another thing as well, the CGI looked awful. I mean, it looked, you know, when the sort of the ships were being blown up and everything, it looked like a really, really bad cartoon. And another thing that is really annoying and galling about this film is the fact that it's not just based on Pearl Harbor. These two pilots in there, they're basically, we're meant to believe that they pretty much had a role in every significant fighter, aircraft battle that occurred in the Second World War, because they start off in pretty much, I think it's the Battle of Britain, where one of them sort of shot down, and he's sort of like, you know, shot down behind enemy lines. Then he escapes, and everyone thinks he's dead, and he gets back to, you know, to America just as Pearl Harbor's about to happen. Pearl Harbor, happens, and then after that, they basically get recruited to lead the bombing run that dropped the Hiroshima bomb on Japan. Which incidentally would not happen because they would not have fighter pilots that they were trained to then be bomber pilots. It just wouldn't happen. It's total absolute bollocks, this entire story. And then the whole trite thing of how this really disturbing thing as well, where he's sort of, you know, he loses, you know, he's thought to be dead. So his friend basically sort of, you know, goes with his former fiance. And then he gets her pregnant, but he in turn is killed. So basically the Ben Affleck character like adopts the kid as his own. So it's almost like everything's set right again. it's just, but the whole story is just absolutely horrible. And this is like in the days, this is because before Michael Bay became like a sort of like a groan every time you sort of see his name on a billboard. It really is a god awful film. And Team America World Police, the song that they have on that about sort of Pearl Harbor sucked, you know, is absolutely perfect. This is one of those films that I think, you know, a lot of times sometimes you get a film like this that will basically, people are basically sort of catty for just because it's the cool thing to hate. You know, a film like Titanic that did massively, massively well, and yet people will sort of like, you know, will sort of like, you know, slag it and sort of attack it and stuff. This is a film that deserves to be absolutely slaughtered. If you want to see a really good film about Pearl Harbor, there's an old classic film called Tora, 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 which is a really, really great movie. You know, and you'll basically sort of, you know, learn all about the Pearl Harbor attack and everything on there. It's, you know, from both sides, from the Japanese and the American side, it's a great war movie. This is not. This is god awful.
I certainly cannot argue with you as far as that is concerned. We're looking at this list for terrible movies. Obviously, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention Pearl Harbor as well, but that's not going to be my slate for the year 2001. Other notable entries I'd probably put in this category would be Jurassic Park 3. I'm looking at this list as well. Hannibal! It's one of these things where I'm kind of tempted to put this on my list as far as honorable mentions for Slate, but I can't bring myself to do it because I'm just looking at it and I'm like, okay, it was disappointing. And certainly, if you had to do it on the basis of the fact that this was a sequel, The Silence of the Lambs, I'd certainly go in that direction. But if you watch the film and take it on its own merit, it's not too bad. So as far as my pick for Slate,
Before you move on from Hannibal, can I just ask, have you actually read the book?
No, I have not. Is it considerably better than what we wound up getting in the 2001
film? The reason why I mentioned the book, I've read the book. I read it when it first came out, and it was one of these books where I couldn't go to sleep until I'd finished it because it got really dark towards the end. The ending is totally different from the film.
That is a shock.
In the sense that it ends where basically Clarice and Hannibal get together.
Oh, I heard something like that. I don't know if it was from you or I heard it from somewhere else.
I think I may have told you, yeah. But yeah, it basically, it goes to the scene where they're basically, where Hannibal's basically eating Ray Liotta's brains. But if I remember correctly, at this point, she's like really massively drugged up. You know, Hannibal's sort of like, you know, he'll do a map, but she's told to, and she sort of joins in with the feast, if I remember correctly. And from that point on, she's so out of it and stuff with the drugs and everything, but him and her and, her and Hannibal basically run off together and they basically become a couple. And it basically ends, the final chapter is basically Hannibal basically reciting how they've basically fallen in love and how they're now a couple and everything. And basically talks about the sex life and stuff like that. And it's just like a really, really weird, bizarre. And it's obviously, when I went to see it, part of the reason why, I mean, I wanted to see it anyway, but part of the reason I was like intrigued was if they would have the guts to basically go down that path. And obviously they didn't, you know, and obviously, you know, but and there's never been a, Thomas Harris, the guy who wrote it, he's never followed up. He did another book after, but it was basically a prequel to the Hannibal stuff. So he's never actually followed up on these novels. So as far as the novels go, it's basically left with Clarice and Hannibal going off into sunset. And I don't know, basically maybe they start a family. Who knows? But it's one of the weirdest endings to a book I've ever read. And it was sort of, as I'm reading it, and sort of like with about like five chapters to go, I thought, is this going the way I'm thinking it's going? And it was one of these things that I was sat in bed till about like 2 a.m. reading it, because I basically wanted to basically get it out my system and just find, I had to basically know where it was going, because you just got a sense it was just getting to this really, really dark place.
Yeah, and that's where I wound up ending as well. All right. For my slate for 2001, I'm going to have to go with the 2001 remake of Planet of the Apes. Dazza, have you seen this film? Or if rather I should ask, have you been unfortunate enough to see this film?
I have seen this film.
Yeah, I mean, God bless your pick of Pearl Harbor. It's certainly not a bad pick, but you really, the idea that when we're going off slate, you can't not mention this film. It's so bad in just so many ways. And you'd expect someone, I believe Tim Burton was the director on this. Am I wrong?
Yeah, it was Tim Burton, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. You expect so much better from the guy because he has such a great track record. But yeah, you think of all people, you never expect him to produce a stinker like this. But unfortunately, it's true. This film is pretty terrible. Obviously, it tries to retell the original Planet of the Apes story with, I guess, a few interesting twists along the way. But for the most part, yeah, this is a pretty god-awful rendition of Planet of the Apes. It wouldn't be later on till we get the prequels that the franchise sort of recovered to a degree. But yeah, this is the film that really sort of soured me on the entire franchise. I still have yet to watch the original, so I'm kind of hesitant. I'm kind of gun-shy just because maybe I'm traumatized from the experience of this film. But yeah, this is one of these films. I think in 2001 I watched as a child. I went to the cinema and I was like, oh, okay, let's watch Planet of the Apes. I've heard so much of this film. I heard it's a classic. It's one of these films that you have to go out of your way to watch. And I was like, okay, let's see if the remake holds up. If not, maybe a little bit better, because, you know, it's Tim Burton here. And I watch it and I'm like, wow, this is, not only is this not good, it's pretty bad, all things considered. And I couldn't tell you one way or another why it's terrible considering the material it's based off of. But if when I look at this list, when I was cruising down, I was like, well, I know I'm going to pick for Raid. But when I made my way to Slayer, I was like, there's so many directions I could go in. But certainly, as soon as I saw Planet of the List. And the funny thing is, it's right in front of Hannibal. And like I mentioned earlier, I was tempted. It's like, oh, I'll just go with Hannibal. I was like, wait. That's Planet of the Apes. That's a much stronger decision. That's a much stronger choice right there. And so that's going to be my rate for 2001.
I grew up, but as a kid, I would watch the originals when we would crop up on TVs and everything. And even, you know, from the time when they were made, you know, they were sort of like, you know, there was a real sort of like, you know, charm and everything to those films. You know, they sort of, I think they still hold up today, you know, for the most part of what they were sort of, you know, achieving. But this one was just sort of, it was one of these things that sort of, special effects had moved on so much, but it's one of these things that, the apes and everything, they didn't have nowhere near the charm of the originals. And you couldn't basically, they were just sort of like, you know, just sort of not something you could relate to. And the ending just didn't make any sense. Ooh. It just, you know, that ended. And the thing is, I think the reason why they did that is because the original one ended on like a time travel twist. But it was one of the best endings to a movie ever. Mm-hmm. And actually, you know, if you're actually sort of not, if you don't know it's coming, absolutely kick him a gut down of an ending. And so sort of, you know, so chilling as well. Whereas this one, I think, was trying to emulate that in some respects, but it doesn't make any sense. it's just absolutely, you know, and absolutely sort of like, you know, just, and you're right, Tim Burton, who up to this point, you know, was a genius. For so many great films that he's done, and this one, it just seemed like out of its, you know, I don't know what they were trying to achieve. It's just sort of just an absolutely awful movie.
Yeah, so that's why when I saw that list, and I was like, well, Hannibal's certainly disappointing, but on its own merit, it doesn't really deserve to be skewered. And then I saw Planet of the Apes, and I even think when I was listing off the top 10, I may have forgot that. But I guess other notables would have been Jurassic Park 3. But to me, the one that sticks out like a sore thumb, it's one of the worst films of all time, in my opinion. It's got to go with the remake of, or at least the 2001 remake of Planet of the Apes.
Yeah. Hannibal at least has Anthony Hopkins, you know, actually sort of, you know, being totally watchable in the scenes that he's in. You know, whereas Planet of the Apes has absolutely got nothing at all.
Exactly.
To sort of, yeah.
All right, doing my gimmick of I look at the remaining 50 films, or the remaining 40, and let's see notable entries in this list. Rush Hour 2. I love that film. It's a fun buddy comedy film. A Beautiful Mind. I have to imagine when we make our way to Oscar nominations, that's probably on there. Other films, Spirited Away
actually reminds me that next year, when we get to 2017, we'll have to do a top 10 of our favorite animated movies.
There you go.
Yeah, because Spirited Away, that's a beautiful film.
Let's see other notable entries on this list. Black Hawk Down. Woo.
The first Fast and the Furious movie.
Yes.
That is a franchise that changed. If you've ever seen the first movie.
Oh, I think I've seen the first either two or three films, and you're certainly right. That franchise took a life of its own, but very different than the original. Let's see other notables on this list. I'm looking at this list as I'm cruising my way. It's like, ooh, have we expanded right in slate to top 50, there were all the other notable entries as well, as far as the ones I like to skewer. Swordfish. That's certainly a terrible movie. Ooh, great film. Training Day.
Now, was that a pun?
What's that?
Was that a pun?
Why?
Films I would like to skewer. Swordfish.
It's one of those things where, yes, let's pretend like I'm not that clever. I'm so smart. Ooh. But a great film. 2001's Training Day. I'm surprised that didn't make its way higher up on the list. Let's see what others is on here. I don't know. Daz, have you seen A Knight's Tale?
Yeah.
That's a great film. You don't like it?
Do I? No, huh? No.
Really? I'm shocked.
No. I don't know. It just sort of, it just didn't feel, it just felt like 21st century, or 20th, actually it would be 20, yeah, 21st century actors. Doing sort of, you know, Arthurian, you know, but didn't sort of, you know, Richard Gere just was talking like a 21st century guy doing, you know, medieval type actor, you know, it just, for me, it just kind of didn't really work.
Okay.
Plus, I'm biased against Sean Connery.
Are we talking about the same film here? A Knight's Tale?
I think of something different.
Let's see. Maybe I'm confusing it for something else. Let's see. I'll do a Google image search. Maybe correct. Perhaps you're right. I don't see Sean Connery on this film, Daza, or Richard Gere.
Okay, what's A Knight's Tale then?
It's the one with Heath Ledger.
Okay.
I was like,
King Arthur.
I was like, Daza, I don't know if that guy's on this film, but I don't want to embarrass you, so I'll just go along with it. And then you mentioned Sean Connery. He's like, okay, I can't let it go. What movie are you talking about, Daza? Let's see other notable entries on this list. Blow. I like that film. I'm curious to see where you fall on this one. It's concerned to Ali.
Do you know what? I'm going to surprise you. I've never actually seen Ali. And I don't know why, because, I mean, I'm basically, it's probably one of the few boxing movies I've never seen. And I never have. And I'm a big Muhammad Ali fan.
Yeah.
But I don't know why I've never got around to watching it.
It's not one of these things where I'm gonna highly recommend it, and as soon as this is over, I tell you to go out of your way. It's certainly interesting. It doesn't really come off as a Muhammad Ali movie. It's just let's see Will Smith try to get himself Oscar nominated, if not win it. And I think he falls short. And I think when we go over the Academy Awards, I think he probably came a little bit short, but. To me, that film is more so less about Ali than it is about Will Smith. It's one of those things where don't go out of your way, but if you happen to be watching it, I'd recommend you sit down and try to watch it, because I'm just curious to see what you think of the film. I think it's certainly a fine performance from Will Smith, but I just think he's not really of that caliber actor, where certainly a fine guy if he's in a blockbuster, and in a film like this, he's certainly fine. He holds his own, but the idea that he's a Oscar nominated, worthy actor. I think he falls short in this film. Something I would have, as a video game fan, I don't know if you've seen this, Dazza, sort of now going back to the opposite, on the 180 scale. Final Fantasy, The Spirits Within, that film is terrible. This is sort of akin to, we sort of talked about this earlier, where we talked about The Phantom Menace, where I watched it, and I was such a big fan of the video game films. I was sort of in denial for the longest time. But then as time went on, I was like, yeah, you know what? That film was pretty terrible. And the fact that it took one of my favorite video games franchise name in vain, it's like, you know what? I really hate that film. Dazza, have you seen Final Fantasy The Spirits Within?
I have, and I feel the same way, because I was a big Final Fantasy VII fan. I absolutely adore that game. And they basically just took the name and just put a second rate sci-fi movie onto it. Had absolutely, you know, if it had absolutely nothing resembling the Final Fantasy universe at all, apart from a few little key elements. Yeah, I was basically, and also, I mean, I think this one was pretty much built on the fact that it was one of the first movies that was just all CGI in attempt to basically replicate, you know, people, you know, yeah, and try and be able to, you know, a realistic, you know, interpretation of people in CGI. And it just sort of, yeah, as a movie, I did not like that. And I think it sort of, it made it, I don't think it was a good movie anyway, but the fact that they tried to sell it off as a Final Fantasy film, you know, that really sort of had issues with me.
I would like the stories that we hear after as far as the Square franchise, that they had so much invested in that film doing so well. Now, when you think about it monetarily, it's like, okay, you had so much writing on that film as far as you being a game developer is concerned. Wouldn't you think to tell a good story? The fact that it would set them back so much. You think if they had so much invested in this film, you think they'd invest a little bit of time in looking at the script? But I guess they may have forgot about that. And they were too up on the visuals and the casting of the film. I will admit the visuals of the film, phenomenal. The casting choices may have been questionable, but still pretty good performances there. But I think what we got in the final product was pretty terrible.
One thing about that film is that with the computer, the Final Fantasy computer games, one of the things that they were sort of so good at was basically, you know, they sort of set them apart at the time and was so groundbreaking in computer game ways, is that they took so much care with the stories. Mm-hmm. They tried to present good stories and also characters who had some sort of depth and who you could basically feel like, you know, some affection, actually care about what happened to them in the film. I mean, if you play Final Fantasy VII, that scene where the little flower girl, I can never say her name, Arif, when she dies at the hands of Seraphoth, that's an amazing scene. I'm absolutely breathtaking. You know, it rivals any sort of, you know, see, it's certainly any scene in an animated movie up to that point. And for them to basically just sort of like, you know, not capitalize on that, not even give you sort of like, you know, the Final Fantasy style, it just felt like a wasted opportunity.
Yeah. And before we move on, I'd be remiss without mentioning this, because it's actually this parlays into a question here. And at number 50 that just barely made the list, Wes Anderson's The Royal Tenenbaums. Now, I don't know about you, Dazza, but I'm a huge fan of Wes Anderson. And if we did sort of something similar to the Quentin Tarantino movies where we did a special just based off of his movies, I'd certainly be fine with that. In fact, I'd probably have a field day with that. But I'm curious to see where you fall on the spectrum. Are you a fan of Wes Anderson?
Not particularly. But really, he's sort of somebody that I've basically... I'm just not that sort of like into his work, to be honest. It's just not somebody that I sort of care about as a director or an author or anything. I kind of feel sort of nonplussed about him, to be honest.
All right, to each their own. There, you just dashed my dreams of ever doing a Wes Anderson special now, Dazza.
I'm sorry.
It's certainly fine, to each their own. Obviously, we do this with the idea it's 100% subjective. All right.
Dazza. Oh, but what I just want to point out is sort of missed Enemy at the Gates.
Mm-hmm.
That was a film I really, really enjoyed. You know, and it's sort of it was quite a film that was sort of quite downbeat. In many ways, but was sort of just this like fascinating story of sort of two snipers, trying to one-upmanship and each other. And Ed Harris was such a great character in that film. There's this awesome movie bit where he's arriving into his first scene. He arrives into Moscow on this train. He's this like world famous sniper, and he's basically eating this meal. And he looks out of his window, and there's all these sort of starving German troops all just sort of sat on the platform, and we're just sort of watching him and sort of have this like luxurious meal. And he just stares at them, and he just really just like callously just closes the curtain. In that one scene, it basically just sums up the character of this sort of like, basically, obviously snobbish, bit of a prick, sort of elitist German who are basically sort of has like a really cold heart. And I just think it was like, you know, as a film, I just really enjoyed it.
Okay. Okay, Dazza. Now, of all these 50 films, what do you think won Best Picture in the year that would follow in 2002?
I think it was Training Day.
Let's see. Dazza, I hate to break it to you, but you are incorrect.
Oh, right. Okay.
Do you want me to go over the nominations, or should I just tell you?
Yeah, do the nominations.
Okay. A film I actually never heard of, Gosford Park. That was a film that was nominated. The Lord of the Rings, The Fellowship of the Ring. Another film I'd never heard of, In the Bedroom, A Beautiful Mind, and Moulin Rouge.
Was it Beautiful Mind?
You would be correct, Dazza. It was Beautiful Mind.
Right, okay.
Let's see. Funny, I mentioned it earlier about Will Smith's performance in Ali, and certainly he was nominated, but he did not win Best Actor in Ali. That would go to Denzel Washington in Training Day. So you were off on what won Best Picture, but when it came to actor and leading role, Training Day did in fact lead to someone winning an Oscar. All right. We talked the best of the best. Let's talk the worst of the worst. Let's see if I could do this right now. I believe I have it now, right? The 22nd Golden Razzie Awards for the films in 2002. All right, let's go over the nominations, and Dazza, you do your best again to try to figure out what won worst film. From Touchstone, as I don't know why I always pick on them first, Pearl Harbor, you certainly had a field day ripping that movie to shreds. It was certainly nominated for worst picture. Was it worst picture in the year 2001? I don't know. We're going to have to wait until we look at the other films. Freddy Got Fingered from 20th Century Fox. Jervin from Franchise Pictures / Warner Brothers. From 20th Century Fox / Columbia, Glitter. And our final nomination, 3,000 Miles to Graceland from Franchise Pictures and Warner Brothers. Dazza, which of these five films was the worst of the bunch?
Okay, I'm going to stick with my choice that I had for my slave, yeah, and I'm going to pick Pearl Harbor.
You'd be wrong, Dazza.
Oh.
I know. It'd be this one film. I don't even know if even heard of the guy, much less this film, but Freddy Got Fingered won Worst Picture. Are you familiar with the, and I do this in quotations, comedian Tom Green?
I am familiar with the comedian Tom Green. He never really sort of made it over here in the consciousness, but
Lucky
I do
bastard.
Remember him because it will crop up in a few films. There was a film, I think it was called Road Trip, that he was in when he did a thing where he's, that famous scene where he's going to feed a mouse to a snake, and he's going, there's that thing about Unleash the Fury. I also remember his TV show used to, his chat show that he had used to get shown in the UK. And they also there was a television show once that used to show like weird shows from other countries. And we did a whole special on him, basically, and all the practical joke things that he used to do. Right, on his like tricks he used to play on his parents and stuff, like where he'd sort of like he'd steal his dad's car and basically do like a lesbian mural across the bonnet and stuff. And I also remember watching the thing that he did with Monica Lewinsky. He did a TV special with her. So I am aware of Tom Green, and that he was basically pretty much a, as I'm aware, is he still a sort of a comedian, or was it a bit of a flash in the pan that once he'd sort of done all the like the disgusting stuff and everything, there was really nowhere else for him to go?
Yeah, he was a bit of a flash in the pan. I think he would, after this year, he would maybe do a few things after that, but after that, his career very much would fade. He would marry Drew Barrymore, but then very much his career just evaporated. So
he married Drew Barrymore.
Yeah, you do not know this?
No.
Yeah,
this I did not know.
Yes, he married Drew Barrymore. The marriage didn't last for a while, so they are currently not together. But yeah, there was in fact a time when Tom Green, at his height of popularity, managed to pull down Drew Barrymore.
Okay. I'm just looking at the guy's bio here, and it says here that they were married from July of 2001 to October 2002. So like you say, he didn't last long. It says here, Green filed for divorce. So he was the one that divorced her. Wow.
Takes all kinds, right?
That's crazy.
Well, it could have been.
I know she's a bit nuts as well, but you know, it's Drew Barrymore. I mean, that's
suck it up, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, she's, yeah, but I mean, yeah, it's just, you know, he's nuts, she's nuts. I just the fact that he was the one that basically, obviously, wanted to finish with her. That's wow. I'm looking at the other stuff that he did after Freddy Got Fingered, and that is. Yeah, I can see why I've sort of not heard of him for a long, long time.
You know, I was reminded when we started talking Tom Green, as far as this guy who was sort of a flash in the pan for doing all these outrageous things. Are you familiar with the comedian Eric Andre?
I feel like you've mentioned him before.
No, I have not, but he's certainly one of these people that feels like it's the 2016 rendition of Tom Green, where he's one of these guys where some of the stuff he does is admittedly kind of funny because he's just so out there, but I get the feeling, you know, he's sort of going to be like Tom Green, where in a couple of years now, he's probably just going to be an answer to a trivia question. But yeah, he's certainly, you look at his comedic style and some of the things he does in public, and it's like, okay, this is a guy who's probably going to end up like Tom Green. Although married to Drew Barrymore, that's certainly not something to sneeze at.
No.
All right, going into the other awards as well. He would also walk away with Freddy Got Fingered as far as his worst role as an actor. He'd win that. He'd win that award. Worst actress would go to Mariah Carey in Glitter. Let's see other. This is another year where they didn't bother to elaborate, because worst screenplay and worst director also go to Tom Green, which I didn't know he was director. You mentioned the animal he abused in one of his films. He would also win worst on-screen couple with the any animal he abuses in Freddy Got Fingered. Let's see. I'm looking at other notable here's. Charles Heston was in Cats and Dogs. He won worst supporting actor, but I was not aware he was in Cats and Dogs. More so, I didn't know he was in obviously it was a cameo, but he was in the remake of Planet of the Apes as well.
Must have been an ape.
Yeah, in the background, I guess, if it was a cameo. Speaking of that film, it won worst remake or sequel. The 2001 Planet of the Apes. And like as always, that's where the nominations are sort of just cut off there. It's odd considering we've seen before, and like I said, I told you eventually we were gonna get to the internet years, and we were gonna get some more so what was legitimately the worst picture, as opposed to let's be catty and let's pick on certain films and certain actors here. And obviously you saw that in Tom Green, but really you can kind of tell where the awards are starting to go with. We've only got like maybe a dozen categories here, whereas before we've had maybe two dozen. They'd go into soundtrack and worst new actor, and it's okay. Like, okay, I can kind of see where they're starting to pull back here as far as giving out the awards here. I think that's going to do it for this week's show. Unless there's anything else I'm forgetting. Des, are there anything you've been working on as of late that you feel like plugging?
It's my Suicide Squad piece. I think I mentioned it last time, but my piece on Suicide Squad versus Justice League, which I've sort of got on why I'm excited for that. I've not really had time to sort of write a great deal. I did write a bit about the latest Stormy and the Tony Avenger situation with Invicta, where she basically sort of where the fight basically got no contest that she had due to the controversy, where basically a bad refereeing decision sort of, forced her to basically sort of be put in a position where she ended up getting tapped from. So that basically, I think that article speaks for itself, so it's not something we need to go over here. But that's pretty much, writing-wise, it's a bit difficult time for me, being Christmas and working retail, that I've not really got the time to basically spend on doing something. But I have got an idea for an article that I'll be doing next. But I will basically sort of speak of that more when I've actually it's basically about one of my favourite comics at the moment that I'm going to do a little piece on. So that's that will be that. But I've seen a few movies this past week. So
That's the thing I forgot to. I'm so out of practice because we're doing such a out of regular show. But since you brought it up, Dazza, has there been any film? I know you're one to often frequent the movie theater. What films have you been checking out as of late that you feel like talking about?
Okay, well, there's actually two films that I've seen. I saw a film last night. It was actually a special preview showing that I saw because I'm a sort of cinema club card member, called Office Christmas Party, which Ooh. Was basically a film, a comedy film with Jason Bateman, Jennifer Aniston. It's one of these films. It was basically a comedy set around basically a Christmas party that gets out of control. It's one of these films that basically it works as a Christmas movie. In the fact that it's just if you want to go and just sort of watch a sort of like watch a funny film that goes a bit out of control, but not too worried about sort of watching any sort of great massively great art, you'll be fine with it. It was funny in places. The humor sort of dipped around the middle and stuff. Basically, the concept of it was that there's a business which is basically having problems, and they want to have an office Christmas party, and Jennifer Aniston's the owner of a company who basically puts a nixnay on it, and they pretty much go ahead with the party anyway, and it basically sort of it ends up going out of control. It ends up with being like turning into a riot. Hookers end up being there. Cocaine's accidentally put in a snowstorm machine. It's just a real sort of real bonkers movie. A lot of fun though. The story was all over the place. There was a couple of sort of storyline threads that just sort of came and sort of went. But with the cast, it had, you know, it had T.J. Miller in there, who was in the Deadpool movie as the sort of the guy behind the counter. It's just a funny film, basically, but not sort of. It's something that any other time of year you wouldn't really sort of pay that much attention to it, but because it's a Christmas movie and it fits in with the season, and it's got all the things, the trappings of, like, you know, the office party and all the things to do with Christmas, but you can sort of relate to it. So I personally enjoyed it for the most part, but it wasn't, you know, the greatest comedy I've ever seen by any means. But you sort of, if you just want to go and see a Christmas movie, it's a good one to go to. The cast is really, really strong, and there's some, like, enough funny moments in there that will basically make it worthwhile going. The other film I saw was a film called Edge of 17, which was basically a film about a young girl with her sort of her teenage problems. Pretty typical sort of film. She's kind of like a bit of a sort of an outcast and a loner, even though she's actually sort of, like, you know, really good looking and really charismatic and everything. So. And she basically has trouble with her home life. She has a dysfunctional family. She has problems at school. She has problems with her best friend, who started going out with her brother. And it's all basically trying to cope with all sorts of that. And also she's coping with sort of trying to basically get together with the hot rebel from school. It all sounds really, really cliche and everything, but it was obviously one of the best films I have seen in 2016.
Huh.
Basically, because the actress, for a start, the actress is called Hailee Steinfeld, and she was absolutely phenomenal. She had so much charisma, and she just had this, like, really sort of sarcastic. She basically just had this sort of, like, really dry delivery when she was basically sort of, like, you know, being funny, but was just absolutely hysterical. Woody Harrelson played her teacher, and he was absolutely a riot. Just so, you know, because he was the teacher that she was always going to with her problems. And he was basically the sort of teacher that basically didn't give a shit about the students, apart from the fact that this was just a job he turned up for. But it just sort of, the whole thing worked. It was absolutely hilarious. But the scenes where she was basically, it was basically a typical teenager type situation where there were times where you felt really, really sorry for her, and there were the times where you really, really wanted to strangle her for being so selfish. Mm-hmm. But every scene that she did, she basically, when she was meant to be doing something that basically was tragic, she pulled it off. When she was being something, when she was being an arsehole, she pulled it off. If she was being funny, she pulled it off. She was absolutely phenomenal in this film. And it was just a really amazing, you know, just a real surprise. It was something that I sort of went, I heard good things about it, and the trailer looked fun, but I went in there thinking it was going to be something, basically, like, sort of, it was going to be one of these films that I went in and watched and sort of came out thinking it was good, but it wasn't really for my demographic. This was a great film. Mm. And I really hope, I mean, the problem with the Oscars is that the Oscar season, there's a lot more politics than you would imagine with the Oscars. You get the impression that they basically just all sit there and just go through the movies themselves. But if you go on Collider and look at their movie, the Collider YouTube channel, and go on there, there's basically, they've done like an introductory guide to the Oscar process. And it basically sort of takes you through what studios do to actually basically get nominated, yeah, and what the criteria
it
is.
Like, it feels like, and it's, I guess it's reminiscent of, like, maybe if a politician was running for office, because that's the way it feels like. It looks like they're actively campaigning and they're trying to win people over. And obviously you can't do this in elections, but they actively bribe the Academy to try to convince them to nominate their film for Best Picture.
I would sort of, because the video will explain it a lot better than I will, but to me, when I was watching it, it was a real eye-opener. I won't go so far as to say it's actually corrupt Although I'm pretty sure that probably goes on, you know, but they wouldn't say that in the video. But it was just an eye opener how the official line of it is basically how it actually works and everything, and how basically many stages there are and everything. And it was just like a real eye opener. I don't know if his studio is going to push this for Oscar contention, but it should, because if nothing else, Hayley Steinfeld, her performance was absolutely incredible. You know, just for what she was trying, what we were trying to do, of basically be to portray an authentic teenager going through these problems, and to join you in as an audience. There was basically, if Leonardo DiCaprio can basically get an Oscar for pretty much sort of grunting and walking through snow and basically looking exhausted and everything, if he can get over that, then she deserves to basically be considered for an Oscar for what she did, because for realism and basically drawing you into a character and making you care, she was phenomenal. And like I said, there were so many layers to her performance. The thing, I think the phrase I'm trying to stumble along is everything she did felt authentic. None of it felt forced or fake, or sort of just done, you know. You basically sort of got the impression that this was a real person with these real problems that you've had. And it also, if nothing else, it was a fun, funny movie. It was, you know, it was some of the best comedy. Woody Harrelson was basically awesome in this. They basically played off each other so well. So, and like I said, I will basically sort of say this is one of the best films that I have seen in 2016. Just a really, really great movie. And it's one that I would, don't feel that you're sort of going to go in there and be seeing some sort of like twee, like Gilmore Girls type show. Even though I've never watched Gilmore Girls and I don't know that much about it, apart from the fact that every woman on Facebook at the moment seems to be watching it. Just get that out there. This was a great, edgy little little film. So I would basically sort of, you know, at least take a look at the trailer and see if it's something that you think you could watch. But I was really surprised at how much I enjoyed this film and came away loving it.
All right. And what's this film again?
Edge of 17.
Ah, okay. Just feel like putting the movie yet again on a plateau here. All right. Since we talked all things you've been watching, Daza, have you been reading anything as of late that you feel like recommending for the folks?
Well, I won't go into it too much because it will spoil something else that I've got planned. Hint, hint. Article. Harley Quinn nearly made me cry last week, so you know. But I'll go into that, you know, later. That was just an amazing emotional issue. But the one thing I've been reading, and I'm still working through it, so I've not got to the end. Is I mentioned it last week. I've been reading Miracle Man.
Yes,
and absolutely. Amazing.
How far are you along in that series? Because it's really good towards the end.
Yeah, I've got into the I'm still on the original creator, i.e. Alan Moore, the version of it. I'm into the second volume. I've just got to the bit where where his daughter's been born. In a massively graphic scene, I have to say.
Yeah, in fact, I believe that I don't know, because I don't know how things are done in the European market. But do they have the advisory on the cover about the graphic birth?
Actually, I'm just going next to me. No, it's just got the mature content.
Okay.
And basically a parental advisory for strong language and content, but he doesn't go into specifics. But yeah, that kind of, I don't think, I remember the videos when I was a kid when we would show his childbirth and stuff, and I've never thought it looked like the most beautiful scene anyway. They always sort of tried to say that how it's the most sort of wonderful scene and stuff like that. And yeah, I never really got that. But in the comic, it was pretty graphic, I've got to say. But also spooky as well, because, like I said, I've only just got to this bit. I don't know if this is going to come down later, but that baby don't look all right to me. I think there's more to this baby. I mean, the baby's almost talked anyway, so there's a little thing there. But the looks of it, the expressions of that baby lead me to think that this is basically, that things are sort of going to So I won't say too much because I don't want you sort of spoiling it for me or anything, but I have my suspicions that this baby is not all that it seems. But the actual, you know, the comic itself is absolutely wonderful. It really shows what we were, what the differences between, you know, because if you look when that was actually written in 1982, you know, that this sort of superhero deconstruction thing that basically Alan Moore was sort of doing, it was sort of so far and away in front of what was actually happening in America, you know, at the time. And I think that, you know, the superhero stories that were done by UK, I think it was kind of like a resentment of superhero comics generally in the UK. So when they actually did superheroes, they would basically do this sort of, basically a more edgier satire on them. But as a comic, I just think it's like absolutely, even putting it to one side, the time when it was and everything, I just think it's just a, you know, an amazing story. You know, just so sort of, and what I love about it, it's one of these things with Alan Moore that Alan Moore always basically states that he basically hates superhero comics. Mm-hmm. And pretty much sort of at times tries to make out that he doesn't write superhero comics. Mm-hmm. You know, he says that Watchmen's not a superhero comic and stuff. And I remember seeing him in an interview once where he basically claimed that him and Frank Miller, they weren't trying to revitalize superhero comics. They were basically trying to bury them. And to me, I think he actually, my personal feeling is, I think inadvertently, I think he basically put new life into superheroes.
Yeah.
I think, even if it was intention to bury them, I think what he did was that he made them relevant again and showed what basically stood to, you know, that there was still life in the concept. And it's sort of, it's a very, in with Miracle Man, it reminds me of what he did with Swamp Thing, where he took a concept that, you know, that didn't really sort of, was basically sort of quite ridiculous in sort of like, you know, modern audiences, and managed to make it plausible by rewriting the origin. You know, this sort of, this whole, like, you know, because I don't know if you know the history of Miracle of Man or Marvel Man,
yes,
as it was called before this, but it was basically, sort of a continuation of the Shazam.
Captain. Oh, yeah, yeah. I'm very familiar with that. And you would see it even when you read the Alan Moore series, but in a couple of the editions of the reprint, they did include a couple of original Miracle Man imprints. And it's like, okay, this, I can see what they were going for, and it was very much a child's comic. But, yeah, you're right. It was done in a style reminiscent of Shazam / Captain Marvel.
Yeah. Well, what actually happened is that Shazam or Captain Marvel, as it was at the time, was actually being published in the UK back in the, I think it was back in the 50s. And then when the Marvel Man comic stopped, because it was basically reprinting those comics like they would do with Marvel later on. And then when they had to cease publishing Captain Marvel in the US, to keep in the UK, once we'd run out of stories, to keep it going, they basically created this new character who was basically just the exact same character, but just basically sort of given a little bit of a makeover, but sort of kept all the elements of it. So it was basically, you know, they could keep, it was pretty much Captain Marvel in all but name and costume. Mm-hmm. You know, it was the exact same thing where he was basically, could turn into like, he was basically a child's alter ego and everything. But yeah, Alan Moore basically sort of took that quite ridiculous concept and basically did something, you know, new and fresh and original with it and made it all plausible. And just sort of, you know, made it interesting. And the stuff that he later did with Captain Britain and everything, he was, just an amazing talent. But yeah, the comic, I absolutely, you know, I'm really enjoying working through it. I'm going through it quite slowly. I don't want to, it's not something I want to binge because it's, there's so much sort of gone into it with the sort of the artwork and everything. It's something I'm sort of savoring as I go along. So it's going to be a while before I actually get to the finish. But yeah, it's coming. I'm wondering why I never actually came across it in the past, to be honest. It's being British and everything. Because I think it's one of these things that it took a long time for them to sort of like, you know, reprint it. And I think it was probably knowing Alan Moore, there's probably been like a few rights disputes over the ownership of it.
I think
and
that's primarily
so.
what took it so long is because I think everybody owned a piece of it, or everybody had the rights to it in some way, shape, or form. So it took forever for Marvel to eventually get all the proper rights to the film so they could reprint it. But yeah, that's basically what happened. It was in dispute forever. No one knew who owned the rights to it. But then eventually, I think Marvel came up on top with as far as the rights to the franchise, and I think that's why eventually it came out. And interesting story. I know you say you're not in a rush to read it, but I can assure you, once it ends, the game and stuff, there's a couple issues. I mean, most of the issues I don't much care for, but I can assure you, Alex and Dave of Comic Conversations certainly enjoy it. So, imagine like eventually you're gonna get to the end of that. But I can assure you, at least maybe not my opinion, but other people I've heard are very much a big fan of the game and stuff as well. And in fact, now that you mention it, there's supposed to be new game and stuff that we're supposed to be getting sometime soon. We were supposed to get it a while ago, the Bronze Age. Because after what you're reading follows what Gaiman would call the Silver Age of the Miracle Man, at least as far as, I guess, what he would call what would be several arcs in the franchise. We're supposed to be getting new Miracle Man, so supposedly, maybe when that makes its way down the line, you may want to pick up and start catching up, because eventually we're going to be getting new Miracle Man.
Yeah, I mean, I've basically bought the four collected editions, the hardbacks in one, in, you know, as a little spending spree. So I'm actually working through the second volume at the moment, but I have actually got all four, so I will basically be, you know, reading the whole lot. But yeah, just a really great. It's got a very sort of British cynicism and sort of, you know, and sort of like a basically, you know, I don't know, just a real attitude to it. You know, it just sort of, when I'm reading it, it just reminds me of not as explicit, but it reminds me of a sort of like the sort of a no holds barred approach they would have and everything. I mean, the scene where he basically, there's a scene where he goes on a rampage. When he's sort of rescuing his wife from the bad guys, and he basically just starts sort of like, you know, crushing like, you know, the henchmen's heads and stuff.
Oh, I like what he does to the doctor.
And the way it's done, but the look in his eyes, it's just amazing. And there's another scene as well where there's one page where you're seeing him flying through his sort of like his through point of view as he's smashing through trees and people and stuff. Just amazingly, you know, creative, and how he basically takes the main bad guy into space and then throws him back at the Earth, so he goes through the atmosphere. Just amazing, just absolutely, you know, just a really, really great comic.
I read that, and the way he just does it, like he's a god. It's like, okay, this is certainly the guy that wrote Dr. Manhattan, because it's like I got that vibe, I got that it reminded me of that character, and I was like, okay, this is the same guy who wrote this is really good stuff here. I'm very much a big fan of. I hate to break it to you, Dazza, but what you've read so far isn't even the best part of the series yet. So so that's something very much to look forward to, Dazza.
Cool.
I mean,
and it's something that you can relate to, even if you're sort of not into like the Shazam type sort of backstory in there. You can basically relate it to sort of a lot of superheroes. I mean, obviously you can relate it to Superman with the whole God thing, but also the whole alter ego thing, because we've got the alter ego going on where you're questioning whether his wife is actually, who does she love more? Does she actually love her real husband, or does she love the Miracle Man? You know, it's just sort of, it's sort of, and who it's actually be, you know, the real alter ego. Just so many sort of, you know, really interesting things they've done with the whole mythos and everything. But yeah, it's one I've really, I'm glad I've really finally got around to reading.
Yeah, so I certainly envy you. You're reading Miracle Man for the first time, and I can assure you this is something that, once you read it, you're going to wish you could forget it and reread it, because it is, in fact, that good. In fact, I know a friend of mine who makes it a habit to, this time of the year, around Christmas, he goes back and rereads it every single year. So I can assure you it is, in fact, very good, Dazza.
Excellent.
All right. I think that's going to do it for this week's show. I mean, we may have done some stuff out of order. Usually this is the part where you plug what you've been working on, but we did that after we did our movie bit. So I think that's going to do it for this week's show, unless there's anything else you will very quickly want to add to the show, Dazza.
No, just watch out for the Christmas show coming soon.
Very much looking forward to that. All right, I think that's going to do it for this week's show. So from all of us at HalfGuard.com, thanks for checking out this week's show. And as always, check you guys out next week. Adios.
Bye.
Ta-da!